This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com.
Good afternoon, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland HedgeGhoul with editor Tommy Graham in the chair. And this is a special HedgeGhoul for schools, and we're delighted to be here in Coulson Hall in Gonzaga College in Dublin. So the format is the usual one. I have a panel here, and you students are going to ask them all difficult questions. So on the panel, on my far right here, I have Colm Kenny, author of A Bitter Winter, The Irish Civil War, 1922 to 1923. And on my immediate right, Mary McAuliffe, Director of Gender Studies at UCD. And on my left, John Dorney, who's the editor of the website The Irish Story, vital for Leaving Cert students, by the way. Nice short articles on it. And then finally, on the far left, Brian Hanley, Assistant Professor of Irish History at Trinity College, Dublin. Okay, now I'm going to start with two questions, right? Because they're related. So could we have Corey Whelan, fifth year Gonzaga, and then I'll go to Dominic Tai. So Corey, could you give us your question first?
To what extent was the Civil War shaped by socioeconomic class? And I was also wondering, have any studies been done on whether volunteers on each side perceived them to be left or more right in economic terms?
And I tell you, I'm going to move straight on then to Dominic Tai for his question.
I was just wondering, is there a correlation between poor mountainous land and anti-treaty sympathies? Were Gaeltacht areas more supportive of the anti-treaty side?
Brian Hanley.
Yeah, I mean, firstly, both really good questions, and class is important, and class is important in many ways in the way people see themselves at the time. But what I would stress is that in the Civil War, you're not talking about a society neatly divided down the middle, with everybody taking sides. There's a very large chunk of the population who aren't involved in the Civil War, and a lot of them are working class. So don't forget that in June 1922, there's a general election which the Labour Party does really, really well. And the Labour Party at the time was overwhelmingly supported by manual working class people. It gets a big vote, and a lot of those people aren't really involved directly in the Civil War, but they're kind of forgotten about when we think of the Civil War, because we assume everybody must have been for or against the treaty. There's actually a lot of people who are neutral, a lot of people who want to stay out of it, and a lot of them are working class. Now, in terms of the treaty and anti-treaty, pro-treaty elite, the politicians, very little difference in terms of class. There are middle class, upper middle class, skilled tradesmen and so on both sides. In terms of the makeup of the fighting forces, the IRA is a very, very mixed bag. It does have people in it who are working class, but it has a substantial number of UCD students. It has a substantial number of people from small business backgrounds or from white-collar backgrounds as well. The Free State Army, interestingly enough, in terms of its rank and file, would be extremely working class, because most of its recruits come from either Dublin, the other large towns, or the small towns of the countryside, often the places where men had traditionally joined the British Army. So when you think about class, it is important, but neither side really fits neatly into the workers are on one side, the bosses are on the other. It's not Spain in 1936. It is more, I think, a division between two different sets of Republicans or Nationalists over a particular settlement, with a lot of people staying out, including a lot of Republicans. The neutral IRA is a very substantial force, and that is people who are in the IRA who don't like the treaty, but they aren't going to fight. So when we think of the Civil War, we have to take those things into account. There is a correlation in where the fighting takes place, however, partly because guerrilla warfare is much more possible in isolated areas. And there you have this question of land, which is very important, which does become intertwined in many cases with hostility to the state, long-term suspicion of the state. So there is greater support for the anti-treaty side in some of the poorer areas of the West. And in terms of the Gaeltachts, I think maybe Mary would know more about it than me.
Yes, Mary, I believe this came up at your conference recently on the Civil War in Kerry.
Yes, we had a Civil War in Kerry conference in Tralee at the weekend, which was very interesting in that taking these discussions to Kerry, where the worst atrocities of the Civil War happened a century ago this month. And we had a discussion about how the periphery, the Western seaboard, sees the fighting go on longer, and in particularly in Kerry, it's much more bitter and more protracted. But up the Western seaboard in places in isolated areas of Galway and Mayo, which would correlate with being Gaeltacht areas as well. Now, I'm not so sure it's specifically because they're Gaeltacht areas. It's more that they're isolated areas. They're mountainy areas. They're areas where guerrilla warfare can be more effectively carried out. And also because, the Irish language makes them other than... You would have a lot of speakers of the Irish language in the National Army, but not among the rank and file. So there being a Gaeltacht area is more because they're isolated. I mean, the Gaeltacht areas in Cork and Meath don't see the same amount of fighting at all during the Civil War. But in the West, they do. So it's a mixture, a kind of intersection of being on the Western seaboard, being in Kerry, where the worst fighting is carried out, and being a Gaeltacht area there. And as Brian said, it's also geography. It's a mountainous region, it's boggy. The anti-treaty soldiers, when they take to the guerrilla warfare, they can hide out there much more effectively than they can, say, within the towns. And the towns are controlled by the state and the National Army anyway at that stage.
No, I did a high school before Christmas on the Civil War in Donegal, and in the Donegal Gaeltacht, a very similar picture. But my impression was it's because of its physical isolation that many of the combatants are not from there. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, and
so the fact
that
Gaeltacht isn't a factor.
They did say that in because we're coming up on the centenary of the Drumbow massacres in Donegal, and actually two of them were from Kerry, weren't they?
Yeah, there were three of them from Kerry.
Yeah, and so they seem like outsiders. They're anti-treatyites in Donegal, so they don't get the support from within the population that the anti-treaty forces in Kerry do, because they're outsiders, they're incomers. So you have to look at that as well. Who's fighting whom and where? And who are they? Are they from among the population? There's so many different factors, you know. Like Brian talked about the fact that class isn't a straight down the line dividing factor in the Civil War. Neither is who's fighting whom and where they are fighting them. So it's a very complex and complicated story.
Okay, I'm going to move on to the next question. Jamie Carson of the 5th Year Gonzaga. Jamie?
Were there any long-term political or social consequences for the Catholic Church due to their excommunication of anti-treaty Republicans? Did the RCC in any sense lose short or long-term support for this? And why did anti-clericalism not become a stronger force in Irish society after the Civil War?
Colm.
Interesting.
I think to answer this question, you've got to really try and feel what it was like to be Catholic in Ireland for a long time, including during this period. It wasn't like a set of ideas. It was like people were immersed in Catholicism. It was their very being. It was part of their identity from way back. There had never been a Protestant Reformation in Ireland. And when it came in England, the Irish very much continued to identify with the unreformed church, with the Catholic Church. And that continued for centuries. And it was just something people took for granted. I'm old enough to remember when nearly every farmhouse in Ireland that was Catholic had a picture of the Sacred Heart in it. People loved the feel of the church more than the institution. It really went to the heart of their spirituality. They didn't know any other way to express that, and it had been with them through hard times for centuries. It kept them going, and its members indeed were alongside them, providing services and providing assistance to them. And when you look at the people in the Civil War, even the ones on the anti-treaty side who were being condemned by the bishops for the damage they were doing, and the bishops in that respect were just like most of the other civil society organizations, like the business groups, the farmers groups, they didn't want the Civil War. But some of the anti-treaty side, people like Liam Mellows, the most extreme of Republicans, if you like, they were deeply Catholic. Their whole language and ideology was Catholic. Part of the reason they refused to compromise in a number of cases was because they thought it was a sin, almost, against their principles, regardless of what the bishops said. So when the bishops came out and, you know, tried to stop, if you like, the anti-treaty side by threats of excommunication and condemnation and letters, it had an impact. But it didn't have a really permanent impact that you might have expected. It would have turned some people very bitter about them for a long time. But for the most part, people went on being Catholics. And the kind of strength that grew out of that for the Catholic Church is what came to be, I suppose, abused later by the power of the church in the Free State and the Republic and led to some of the alienation that we now witness. But really the key to it, in my opinion, is just to think of it as a very different thing at that stage.
Now, I'm going to move on to our next question. Kevin Cousin.
What was the divide between ex-IRA men and ex-British soldiers in the Free State Army? And was the Free State government and its forces collaborationist?
John Dorney.
Okay, so in talking about the Civil War, like, some of the things we tend to do nowadays, I think, is try to play down the Civil War in a way and say it wasn't a counter-revolution or it wasn't, you know, as bitter as we want to say. And the reason for this is because the picture at the time is so complicated. But in terms of people's memory of the Civil War, I think is even more important. Like, someone asked about class the other day. After the Civil War, the anti-treatyites are in a position where they feel that they're excluded from the society, that the revolution failed. They're trying to bring down the state. So it becomes a mode of opposition to the Irish state. And it still is today. You can still see that strain right through today. So Sinn Féin is an Irish Republican Party. It traces its roots back to 1922 and the split then. And there's a very strong, as we know, class element to it. It's, you know, the locus of opposition to the state is based in that. Now, the funny thing is, that's not necessarily how it was at the time of the split in 1922. So regard the National Army or the Free State Army or the Pro-Treaty Army. Initially, it's all IRA. So the first units of it were recruited in Dublin, the Dublin Guard, and they were recruited from Michael Collins followers, really, in the Dublin IRA. So the majority of the IRA in Dublin was anti-treaty, but the core of the National Army was the pro-treaty ones, the people who'd been very closely involved with intelligence, with Michael Collins, with the squad. That's the first unit. Now, units are, they take over Beggar's Bush Barracks, which you might know, it's now a court or something down in Dublin 4 near Lansdowne Road, the Aviva Stadium. And various units are rotated in and out and they get their uniforms and so on. But by the time the Civil War breaks out, the National Army has maybe 8,000 members in it. And the vast majority of them at that point are former IRA. Or they would even at that point call themselves things like the official IRA or the real IRA. You know, I know those terms have modern day resonance, but that's what they call themselves at the time. Now, when the Civil War broke out, which the government really hadn't anticipated, you need lots more people and you need people with military training. And where do you get them? You get them from the thousands and thousands of Irish men who'd been in the British Army in the First World War. So of the 55,000 odd members of the Free State Army, you have various people saying there's half of them are British Army veterans. And this is possible, but to be honest with you, I don't know how anyone has such an exact figure because we don't have such a detailed roll about everyone's service. There's certainly a very large number of them. But in terms of the officers, yes, they recruit former British Army officers who had been in the Irishmen usually, although there's a few, actually one or two British. The high command of the National Army or the Pro-Treaty Army is again overwhelmingly ex-IRA. They're Michael Collins men. You know, they're the people who had been on the Army Council of the IRA in 1921. So it's, you know, it's difficult because it complicates our picture. Like the picture we have of the Civil War in terms of what it means. You know, it's you know, the opposition to the state is the anti-treatyites, the Republicans who are anti-establishment. It's not necessarily how it looks in 1922. Now, your question was, were they collaborationist force? So, no, they weren't. They were, in the main, they were Irish nationalists, Irish Republicans. However, and it's a big however, how you're seen is almost as important as how you see yourself. So the anti-treatyites, the Civil War itself generated a huge bitterness among them. And the likes of Todd Andrews, who's a Dublin man, he would say, I saw these people as traitors, as Castle Catholics, he used that word. They put us down, they murdered our comrades, they tortured us on behalf of the British. Now, in the cold light of day 100 years on, I don't think that's a fair judgment, but that's the way the anti-treatyites sincerely saw it at the time. They said the revolution had failed and we were defeated by a bunch of traitors.
Brian, you want to come in on that?
It is important, however, that the Free State government was able to win ultimately because of huge military aid from Britain. I mean, the British want the Free State side to win and therefore provide huge amounts of military equipment to the army and also are prepared to bankroll the Free State up to a point as well so it won't collapse. So that's important for them. but also in terms of the ex-British soldiers. I mean, again, they can be demonized because I think people might have in their minds when they hear ex-British soldier that this is a black and tan coming back to have another go at the IRA. Most of these guys are Irish men who'd been in the Great War, for example. But the bad stuff, the really horrific stuff that's done during the Civil War by the Free State side tends to be done by the IRA veterans, particularly that group from Dublin who'd been in the squad, been in intelligence. They're the ones who do most of the really bad killings in the dirty war phase. They're the ones involved in Ballyseedy. These aren't ex-British soldiers who are doing this. It's actually the core of the old Dublin IRA.
Just one more thing briefly, sorry, Tommy, on this. One thing that's interesting, though, about, again, the long-term effect of the Civil War is these guys who we're talking about, the ex-IRA, the squad, the Dublin Guard in the IRA, who had been involved in lots of murders and massacres, tortures and stuff in the Civil War, mostly left the army in 1924, though, because they tried a mutiny. They tried to overthrow the very state they'd been fighting for. And as a result, actually, the Irish army, as it was founded then and as it continues today, is much more strongly influenced, I would say, by the people who were in the British army. You know, much more apolitical, much more about service to the state. The ex-IRA thing is kind of weeded out of the Irish army after the Civil War in about 1924.
Yeah, just might add to that. You have to remember the sheer numbers of people who were in the British Army, about 200,000. So it's unremarkable that ex-British soldiers would be in any organisation of whatever stripe. And you also have to bear in mind that there were many ex-British Army people on the anti-treaty side. I mean, Tom Barry is the most famous example of that. So, you know, just because you're British Army, I don't think it really says that much because so many were. And of course, the First World War was the biggest war quantitatively the Irish people were ever involved in. Anyway, let's move on to our next question. Olivia Doyle, fifth year, St. Conlett's.
Were any women in leadership positions in either regular or irregular forces during the Civil War? If so, how'd they get on?
Mary.
Yes, that's a very interesting question, Olivia. Women were in leadership positions during the Civil War for a number of reasons, mainly one that an awful lot of the men who were in leadership positions were imprisoned early on. For example, when Austin Stack was arrested, he was the quartermaster general of the anti-treaty IRA, Margaret Skinner takes over that position. And when she is arrested, Nora Connolly O'Brien, James Connolly's daughter, takes over that position. But in terms of leadership positions, what the Common Amon are doing during the Civil War is what they had done during the War of Independence, except they become much more militant during the Civil War, is they are in alliance with the anti-treaty IRA, and Common Amon are mostly anti-treaty. They're providing intelligence gathering, dispatch carrying, running safe houses, protecting arms dumps, and they're providing an effective backup to the anti-treaty IRA to conduct a guerrilla war without them. The war couldn't have been conducted in the way that it was conducted. But they were also doing some stuff that they didn't do during the War of Independence. For example, Ethna Coyle in Donegal is holding up, with a group of men, held up a train to rob a train. And they're doing much more militant work during this period. And they're also very, very important when it comes to propaganda. And it is an awful lot of the women who are running the anti-treaty propaganda, making sure that the anti-treaty propaganda news sheets like Public na hÉireann, Éire, the Fenian are all getting out. Or in Tralee, in my hometown in Kerry, there's a news sheet called The Invincible. And that really antagonises the leader of the anti-treaty or the National Army forces in Kerry. That's General Paddy O'Daly of the Dublin Guard. And he's determined to find these women. And there are two young women who are running this, two sisters, Jo and Sis Power, Power sisters. They're arrested and they're put into Kilmainham Jail. And just to show you the effectiveness, you say, how did they get on? The effectiveness of the Common Amon during the Civil War, I think, is most shown in the fact that the numbers of them arrested and imprisoned during the Civil War far exceeds the numbers arrested during the War of Independence. There's almost 600 of them arrested and imprisoned, either in Kilmainham Jail, Mountjoy Jail, then in the North Dublin Union, or quite a number of them are held in local prisons in barracks like Ballymullen Barracks or Moidewell Jail. Actually, Ethna Coyle was for a time imprisoned in Ballyshannon, and they're held locally. They might be held for a few days, a week. And what's happening to them there is quite difficult to read about. They are mistreated pretty badly, brutalized in some cases, tortured. There is a report of a woman in Moidewell jail where she was called in by the senior officer and a gun put to her head and threatened with being executed if she didn't give up some information. Now, no woman is executed like the men are executed or tied to mines or ambushed like that. But they are mistreated hugely because of their importance to the anti-treaty IRA. So, obviously, after the Civil War, the Cumann na mBan obviously stopped when it came to an end. And you find that they are, for the most part, unable. It takes them a long time to settle in to the Irish Free State, and the Irish Free State treats them pretty badly in the next few decades. And indeed, women can't apply for military pensions until Fianna Fáil come to power. In the 1930s, the Cumann na Gael government don't allow them. Cumann na mBan are excluded from military pension applications until Fianna Fáil come to power. And of course, as many of them said, Ireland becomes no country for women, really. And that's a combination of church and state, but also the dislike of these furies, these deranged revolutionaries that Cosgrave called them, going on into the Irish Free State, and they needed to be controlled.
Just to maybe talk to us about Margaret Skinner, because, I mean, she actually fought gun in hand like throughout the revolutionary period, yet she couldn't get a pension. Just talk to us about that, Mary.
Yeah, she applied for the pension in 1923 when the first Pension Act was passed. And she applied as a member of the Irish Citizen Army because, as I said, Cumann na mBan were excluded. But actually, technically, she fought in 1916 as a member of the Irish Citizen Army at the Royal College of Surgeons outpost. And she put on a male uniform and was a sniper and actually was wounded three times, leading an attack on a British Army sniper nest, which was keeping them pinned down in the Royal College of Surgeons. So she had and then the War of Independence, she fought as a member of Cumann na mBan. She's anti-treaty, ends up in prison in Mountjoy Jail. She goes on hunger strike kind of number of times. She's in prison for almost a year. Goes on hunger strike three times, and then she's released and can't get a job because very few anti-treaty men or women are able to get jobs, and applies for her pension. And she is turned down technically because the Pension Act describes the soldier only in the masculine sense. So the fact that she was a sniper, the fact that she was wounded, the fact that she continued to fight through the War of Independence and Civil War, as I said, she becomes quartermaster general of the anti-treaty IRA for a short time in the Civil War. She's importing arms and ammunition from Scotland. She was born in Scotland, and she's turned down. But actually, the reality is she was turned down because Cosgrave said no women, no anti-treaty people will get a pension. Another woman does get a pension at that time, but she's a pro-treaty woman, and she's the only woman who does get it then. That's, I forget her name.
Bridget Lyons Thornton.
Bridget Lyons Thornton, who had been pro-treaty. But no, Margaret Skinner gets turned down.
So, I mean, from what you're saying, then, though, that you're talking about women in leadership roles on the anti-treaty side. What about on the pro-treaty side?
The pro-treaty side, when Cumann na mBan split, a new organisation comes into being, which very few people hear about, but it's very important. It only lasts the year, 22 to 23. But it contains many of the founder members of old Cumann na mBan when it was founded in 1914, like Jenny Wise Power, and they are Cumann na Saoirse. And Cumann na Saoirse provide for the National Army, both political but also financially. They do fundraising drives, they do hospital visits, but they're also very much campaigning for the treaty. And one of their big things is to make sure that the government knows that not all women were against the treaty. That was one of their phrases. And they believe that the treaty, they take the Collins idea that the treaty is a stepping stone to victory. So you have a number of women who are both leading ex-Cumann na mBan, but also who are the wives of people like Min Mulcahy, the wife of Richard Mulcahy, the head of the army, Alice Stopford Green, who was a senator in the Irish Free State Senate, appointed by Cosgrave, and many leading women of both the political and military in the Free State, they're married to these men, and they're in Cumann na Saoirse.
What was the nickname, Mary?
Cumann na Searchers. Yes, Cumann na Searchers. They were also used as lady searchers. When the Cumann na Mon women were arrested and put in jail, obviously you needed a woman to search them. And so the Cumann na Saoirse are used. And that's a real bitterness between the two groups of women who had been comrades. So when people talk about brother against brother, the Irish Civil War is as brother against brother, it's also sister against sister. They do spy on each other. They do turn each other in. Cumann na Saoirse organizer came to Thurles in Tipperary and was taken prisoner by the local Cumann na Mon and more or less beaten up and told to get out of town. So there's a real bitterness there. And that bitterness only dissipates in the 1920s when they have a common enemy. And that common enemy, of course, is the state that is making all women second-class citizens.
John, you want to come in quickly?
Yeah, just to add to what Mary is saying, like today, you know, feminism is really part of the mainstream discourse. And so that might lead people to believe that we're overemphasizing the role of women in some of these events, 100 years ago. And certainly in the case of the Civil War, that's not the case. So if you look at the army records of the time of the Civil War, on the West Coast, which we were talking about, where a lot of the Civil War happens, you know, where you don't have lots of women who've been to college and stuff, but nevertheless, what the army says is what's keeping the Civil War going is the women. The women are the problem. The women are the fanatics. They particularly talk about women who are national school teachers, which is very interesting, you know, because most people at the time had only national school education. And just to illustrate this, like the Civil War is not all about guns and bombs. It's also like a social confrontation. So in October 1922, the bishops of Ireland, and we talked about this a bit already, Colm talked about it, condemned the anti-treatyites, and they didn't quite excommunicate them, actually. What they said was they can't have sacraments, so they can't go to communion and stuff while they're bearing arms against the Irish government. Now, this is read out, it's a pastoral, in churches up and down the country. And in one church in County Kerry, I think it's Ballyhaig, but I could be corrected on that, Mary.
It's down South Kerry, all right.
Yeah, Mary knows this anecdote as well, but it's a great story. So the Cumann na Mon, the local Cumann na Mon activist, gets up on the pulpit, on the altar, and rips up the pastoral in front of the priest, you know, to the shock of the local people. The priest ordered a boycott on her, and the next day when she arrived in school, I presume it was a Monday, the national school students had raw potatoes and they pelted her with the potatoes as she's trying to get into her school. So, but the IRA didn't take that lying down either. They put a boycott on the priest and they confiscated his potatoes.
His donkey.
So, you know, this is what the Civil War meant. I mean, you know, I didn't really like the movie The Banshees of Inisherin, actually, but like...
Me neither.
But however, if you can imagine a society like that where people are fighting each other in this very kind of intimate way, the Civil War is like this. And the women, the Cumann na Mon women, are seen by the army actually as even a bigger threat than the men, in the sense that they're the thing that are keeping us going. The men with the arms would actually give up if it wasn't for the women, is what the army thinks at the time.
A few weeks after that, she was arrested and ended up in Kilmainham for the rest of the time.
Yeah. Well, one more thing, sorry, just because I love my anecdotes. So with regard to Cumann na Searchers, Cumann na Saoirse, the pro-treaty group, you know, the women were first held in Kilmainham jail and then they were moved to North Dublin Union. Well, the people given the job of moving them were Cumann na Saoirse, and there's a really ferocious riot between the women of the two sides in the prisons in Dublin in 1923.
Okay, I'm going to move on to our next question. Caoimhe Mór, six-year St. Conlath's.
So just wondering, what percentage of anti-treaty soldiers were openly anti-clerical, like the Cillian Murphy character in The Wind That Shakes the Barley? And then also, because organised socialism tends to be stronger in urban areas, were Dublin IRA volunteers generally more left-wing?
Actually, Brian, I wouldn't mind a few comments, by the way, from maybe the rest of the panel as well, on that film, The Wind That Shakes the Barley, because I assume it's probably a required viewing by all Leaving Cert students. I certainly use it for my students. Brian?
Yeah, there's a longer version of your question which mentions anti-clericalism in the Parnell era. And that's really interesting, because I think to answer your question, I have to say Irish republicanism isn't static. And the Fenians in 1867 publish a proclamation, which you should look up if you ever get the chance. It's far more anti-clerical and secular than the 1916 proclamation. Irish Republicans were not anti-clerical in general. In 1920, Sean T. O'Kelly of Sinn Féin goes to Rome to try and get an audience with the Vatican. And he's on the anti-treaty side a couple of years later. And what he says to the Vatican is, we are not like Republicans in Italy or in France or in Spain. We are a brand of Republicanism who are proud to be Catholic. So most Republicans were not anti-clerical. Many of them are embittered by condemnation from the church. But what they tend to say is that the church is wrong to take, if they had done it historically, the side of the British, or to take the side of the Free State. But that doesn't mean the church is wrong in religious terms. So we reject what they say about the IRA, but we don't reject what they say about contraception or what they say about divorce or these other things. So you don't see a large group of people break away and say, well, to hell with the Catholic Church, we should do away with them. What Republicans tend to say is, I disagree very much with the church on this, but I'll find a priest who'll give me communion or confession. Because even in The Wind That Shakes the Barley, when Damien is speaking in church, he says, the Catholic Church, with honourable exceptions, and there were, you see, honourable exceptions. They were orders, lay orders and so on. They were priests, individual priests, who would give confession or give communion to anti-treatyites. So there were ways around this general anti-clerical clampdown. But it's also important to say as well that the Vatican disagreed with the Irish Church. In 1936 in Spain, the Vatican knows exactly what side it's on. One side are for Christ, one side for Antichrist, in their view. The Vatican sees the Irish Civil War as a tragedy because both sides are largely Catholic. And the Vatican thinks the Irish Church have made a mistake in coming down so heavily on the Free State side. And particularly, there's an inference that the Church actually support executions. And the Vatican's very, very wary of that. You know, they think, hang on, how, you know, the Vatican is clear. We'll lose Catholic Ireland. The Vatican's also, you see, worried about what the Protestants think. The Protestants of Northern Europe always thought, why are Spain and Italy and all these places unstable? Because they're Catholic. So suddenly there's this new Catholic nation coming into being. And if it has a civil war, Protestants are going to say, well, that's the Catholics at it again. So the Vatican would like a much more a compromise solution. So again, it shows you how complex this is. There is only a minority who really draw anti-clerical conclusions. Most disagree with the church, but manage to get on with it. And on your other point, which is also important, the biggest growth area for radical trade unionism in the revolutionary era is not actually Dublin or the towns. It's farm labourers. So the transport union, for example, which had been based in Dublin, which we associate with the lockout, that grows to 120,000 members by 1920, and 60,000 of them are farm labourers. So it's actually in the countryside very often that you get a lot more radical trade unionists.
And presumably, Brian, they'd be the bulk of that Labour vote that we talked about earlier.
A lawful of the seats Labour win are actually in the small town, rural hinterland. Someone like Paddy Gaffney, who's elected in Laois Offaly, who leaves the Labour Party and joins the Communist Party, in fact. But he worked in a flour mill. And you wouldn't again think of necessarily communism being strong in Carlow or Laois Offaly. But that's actually where you do get a lot of radical working class sentiment at that time. So there is a very radical Labour movement, and it's split three ways on the treaty. The Citizens' Army, which still exists, splits three ways. A few of them actually join the Free State Forces, some are neutral, and some join the anti-treaty IRA. And that happens to kind of Labour as well.
Colm, you want to come in there?
Just briefly to make two points. First of all, we talk about republicanism in Ireland, and it's important to remember republicanism in Ireland was not a very clearly defined creed. It was not like in France. Nobody was looking for laicization of the state that they were going to found. It's a loose word used to describe a certain body of thinking. The second thing is, I think it's a mistake to think that such anti-clericalism as there was all on the anti-treaty side. Arthur Griffith, the great leader, founder of Sinn Féin, was described as anti-clerical by W.B. Yeats in the early 20th century. His first great paper, The United Irishman, that he edited, was shut down by a libel action by a priest in Tipperary. And later on, during the treaty negotiations, he gives a very short answer to a query from the rector of the Irish College in Rome, and you find De Valera writing a kind of letter of apology or justification almost. De Valera used to boast of being surrounded by priests, and I sometimes think one of the unanswered questions of this period is the extent to which Griffith himself was regarded with suspicion by the bishops, who were much more comfortable with a figure like De Valera, on whom they felt they could depend in relation to the long-term future of their institution.
Just while we're on the question of the wind that shakes the barley, any members of the panel want to comment on it? Brian or John?
But just briefly, I like The Wind That Shakes the Barley, but you know, Ken Loach, who made it, is a very left-wing filmmaker. And Ken Loach also, I think, going back to what I said earlier, picks up very strongly on the whole anti-establishment left-wing thing that Irish republicanism really developed after the Civil War. So people like Padraig O'Donnell, who's a left-wing republican at the time, an anti-treatyite, is very influential in his writings and so on in recasting the Civil War as, you know, the men of no property, to use Wolfe Tone's phrase, was used by Liam Mellows, who was executed in the Civil War, against the establishment. And there's a grain of truth in that, but it's, you know, the Civil War itself is a lot more complicated and anarchic, to be honest, chaotic than that. So I think that's kind of overemphasized in The Wind That Shakes the Barley. What is really good about The Wind That Shakes the Barley, I think, is it shows things like the Dáil courts, which are set up like, which are kind of like people's courts, if you like. They're set up during the War of Independence, and they're actually abolished in the Civil War, you know, by the Free State, by the government.
It shows violence against women.
And it, and it shows violence
powerful,
against women. Right, yeah. So
scene.
Yeah, if you want to talk about that bit, yeah.
Of hair cropping. I don't know if many of you have seen The Wind Shakes the Barley, yes?
Show hands there.
There is a very powerful scene in it where the Black and Tans are searching a house and they drag out a young woman and they beat her up and rough her up and then they forcibly hair crop her, and that's very much a gendered punishment that was prevalent during the War of Independence. In fairness, on both sides, not just the Black and Tans and auxiliaries and the Crown Forces, but the IRA were also doing it and Sinn Féin were also doing it to young women for company keeping. And company keeping was the phrase used of those young women who were seen to be stepping out with soldiers or RIC men or just saying hello to them, or maybe were some older women might have been supplying maybe milk or turf to the RIC barracks. So on both sides, you have armed men attacking women for ideological reasons. And in my research, to show the War of Independence was not a clean war, I have about 260 individual cases of young women dragged out of their beds, mostly late at night, and hair cropped. And that isn't a nice thing. It isn't that their hair was shaved. It was pulled out and dragged out and clipped out. And you can imagine the violence of that. So, yeah, that use of that gendered punishment was very prevalent. And so The Wind That Shakes the Barley shows an instance of that. And I think that's very powerful.
Brian?
Yeah, how many have seen Michael Collins' movie?
Much more.
Well, The Wind That Shakes the Barley is a lot better movie than
yes,
Collins.
It is.
Yeah.
Michael Collins is a good movie, but it's only wrong in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Okay, tell you, just...
Julia Roberts' Irish accent, for one.
Just on one point about the Dáil court scene in The Wind That Shakes the Barley, I always give a warning to my students that it gives the impression that Dáil courts gave radical judgments, whereas they tended to give very conservative judgments. I think that's why they were successful.
Yes.
The point was they were giving judgments at all. That was the point, not the nature, you know, right wing or left wing or whatever, socially radical. It was the fact that they completely took the ground from under the legitimacy of the British legal system. Anyway, we'll move on to our next question. Toby Burns, fifth year Gonzaga.
So I've seen a photo of a British army tank ramming a premises on Capel Street in January 1921. And so did the tanks and airplanes and other new technology have a large role in Civil War? And if so, when and where and how effective were they?
John. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So it's a famous photograph of 1921, and it's the tank, the World War One tank, has been used to break open a house in the British Army in their war in Ireland. They cordoned off parts of the city for several days and they broke in looking for people. So in the Civil War, though, in some ways, because both sides in the Civil War were kind of inexperienced, they were really keen adapters of new technology. So the British Army had their old traditions. They used a lot of cavalry, for example, sweeping the countryside in the War of Independence. You don't see that in the Civil War there. They adopt the new technology wherever they can. So regards tanks, no, the tanks of the day, first of all, the British didn't hand over any to the Free State Army, the National Army. But regards armored cars, they're very useful because they can move rapidly on the road. Usually they can't move off-road, but they can use rapidly. They're obviously armored. Bullets can't get in. Explosives can, but you have to, in those days, you have to set up an explosive with a cable leading out of it. It's kind of cumbersome. And they're usually armed with heavy machine guns. So in the case of the Rolls-Royce armored car, it has a swivel-mounted turret, so it can go around in a circle and it can spray out bullets. And when these show up, they're an overwhelming advantage. One of the interesting things about the early months of the Civil War, where there's kind of stand-up fighting between the two sides, is that the anti-treaty side, the Republican side, also had armored cars. Some of these were taken off the British as they were leaving. One or two were seized off Free State forces. But also, there was improvised armored cars that were made in Cork. And so the idea is basically nailing on armor to a regular car and mounting a machine gun on it. And so in the encounters in County Limerick in the Civil War, which are kind of the largest military encounters of the Civil War, what you see typically is both sides of armored cars, and the armored cars actually blast away at each other. Now, the Republican ones fall out of use during the Civil War. And so this is one of the big advantages of the pro-treaty side. When there is a prolonged engagement, like I could give you an example of in Dublin, the Republicans made a number of attempts to attack Oriel House, which was the centre of Free State Intelligence. It's right beside Trinity College. The minute an armoured car shows up with its armour and its machine gun, that's it. They have to get out of there because they have nothing that can take it on. They don't have any anti-tank weapons like we see today, for example, in Ukraine. Regarding aeroplanes, again, the Free State inherited a squadron of fighter planes and reconnaissance planes from the British, and they were based in what's now Dublin Airport. At that time, it's called Collinstown Aerodrome. And they used them a lot in the Civil War, not so much for bombing and for ground attack, but mainly for reconnaissance. And this is a big deal because if you're a guerrilla, the big thing is not to be found. It's relatively easy to hide for someone on the ground at the same level of you. It's very hard to hide from an aeroplane. There's one or two cases as well down in Cork and Kerry where the planes are actually used on bombing missions when they find guerrilla columns, but this is fairly rare. Usually they're used for scouting and reconnaissance. But basically, and also you can also say the same thing in terms of some of the arms used, like they're very quick adopters of the submachine gun. You've probably seen the Tommy gun in various gangster movies and stuff like that. Both sides are very keen to use that. So in some ways, in the Civil War, they're both very keen adopters of the latest technology they could get their hands on.
Now, what about artillery, John? Because surely that's crucial to the war.
Yeah, so artillery is not new, but artillery is kind of decides the first phase of the Civil War. So the British hand over, I think, 7 or 8, if I remember, artillery pieces to the Free State Army. They're not the heaviest ones that they have. They're field artillery. But the fact is, the Free State, the pro-treaty side, had artillery, which can blast holes in buildings, and the anti-treaty side didn't. They had a couple of attempts to set up improvised mortars and stuff like that, but they never worked. So when the Civil War in its opening month or so is a question of seizing towns and seizing territory, the side that has artillery, that has the big guns, has an overwhelming advantage. And this is usually the case.
There was particular striking attack. You've mentioned, John, about how the planes were occasionally used in Munster. A remarkable man called James Fitzmaurice, lieutenant in the Irish Air Force. He was later to be one of the first people. He was later to be the first person, along with two Germans, to fly directly from Europe to North America on board the Bremen. But at this stage, in December 1922, the Cork Examiner has a report of him attacking a column of anti-treaty forces in Cork. And Fitzmaurice is quoted as saying, "I hadn't been long bombing. He spotted a column in a bleak, wild place on the side of a mountain between Leap and Drimaleague, affording plenty of cover to the irregulars." That the irregulars were what they call the anti-treaty troops. "I'd not been long bombing when I observed the column in a state of wild confusion, terror-stricken and panicky. Some ran for cover in gorse bushes, and he bombed them with what he called excellent results. Others made it to the wood. I raked the wood and gorse bushes with heavy machine gun fire." And he didn't apologise for any of this. He justified it, saying that soldiers of the National Army were being shot down, ambushed and mutilated in the most shocking way by the anti-treaty forces. Now, that was the report in the Cork Examiner. I can't say it was true, but it was certainly his colourful account of what had happened there.
Just on the Thompson submachine gun, by the way, Colonel Thompson, who developed it as a trench-clearing weapon. I love these military euphemisms because it's nice and short. He didn't realise that he was actually being bankrolled by Clan na Gael, the IRB's American organisation. So there was an Irish involvement right at the ground floor of the Thompson submachine guns development, and it was first used in combat in anger in Drumcondra, in this city. And of course, if you notice that it crops up in many, many photographs. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, it's the same 3 or 4 guns being passed around, right, for propaganda reasons, because the main consignment didn't come in until much later. In fact, some of them didn't get into the country, you know, right up to the 1970s in the recent Northern Troubles. Some of them surfaced then, you know.
Yeah, so just on that, Tommy, briefly, like the Tommy gun, yeah, has just a symbolic use in the War of Independence. In the Civil War, there's lots of them around. Like most IRA columns have 2 or 3 or 4 of them. And typically, you know, the they're not much use at long range, but at close range, they're very dangerous weapons. They have a 100-round drum, and you can, if you spray kind of a room, you might hit everything in it, you know.
Or not, as the case might be, yes. Anyway, listen, let's move on to our next question from Sophie Davey, 6th year at Muckross College.
Sexual crimes are usually a feature of war.
To what extent were sexual crimes and tarring and feathering a feature of the Irish Civil War, and how did people at the time treat stories and allegations about these issues?
Mary, we've touched on this already, but...
Well, that's exactly the type of research I'm doing at the moment, and I'm on sabbatical, so I'm writing a book on that very subject of the War of Independence and Civil War. So watch out for that when it comes out. Gendered and sexual violence against women in the revolutionary period broadly. The Revolutionary Wars, War of Independence, Civil War, are not clean wars. They'd been talked about as that, and that they, you know, some few drunken black and tans attacked women, but otherwise it was a clean war. My research and the research of others has shown that is not the case. And that continues on into the Civil War. Now, tarring and feathering and hair cropping is not as prevalent in the Civil War, but what you get is more brutalization of women by the National Army, particularly because, and militant anti-treaty women, because of their effectiveness on the anti-treaty side. You also get, I'm looking at Kerry quite closely at the moment. So the anti-treaty force or the National Army come into Kerry in August 1922, and by the 9th of September, they have started already on their physical and sexualized attacks on women. On the 9th of September 1922 in Killarney, six young women were dragged out of their beds, six Cumann na mBan women, known to be, and it says in the reports, known to be irregular sympathizers. And again, irregulars is the name for the anti-treaty forces that are used. They're stripped naked, harassed, and are painted green by the National Army troops. And this is reported in the national newspaper, in the Irish Independent, actually, carries the report. And so too the anti-treaty propaganda. It's in Public na hÉireann and it's in the Fenian newspaper. So the newspapers are carrying reports of these attacks on women. And they're horrified by this. And just in case we think this is propaganda on the part of any of these newspapers, actually, one of the women who was attacked that night subsequently puts in a pension application, and she mentions that attack. And she says after that attack, she was so traumatized about it, her nerves were gone. And there is a real implication there that there was more happened to them that night than simply being stripped naked and painted green from the breast down. They were also told to appear the next day in public to show that nothing happened to them at all, and, you know, what were they talking about, so that they couldn't use it for propaganda. But in fact, it is used for propaganda by the anti-treatyites. And you can see that happening again and again, those type of attacks. After the mine at Knocknagoshal that killed five National Army soldiers, that's anniversary is coming up next week, 6th of March, there is a sweeping of the area. And of course, Ballyseedy happens within 24 hours. But also at that time, young women are being arrested because a woman wrote the note that got the National Army men to go to the place where they were. They then unfortunately disturbed the mine that exploded and killed them all, mangled them. You know, it was a horrific killing. And she, Kathleen Walsh, and her three sisters were taken in to Hartnett's Hotel, which was the National Army headquarters in Castle Island, where they were forcibly hair-cropped under torture. And that's just the sentence, you know. Then you have to ask the question, what was the torture that they had to endure there? You also have the young women being arrested for propagandizing. The Power Sisters, whom I mentioned, after Ballyseedy are putting up news sheets on the walls of Tralee saying, don't join O'Daly. Paddy O'Daly was the officer commanding of the Kerry command. Don't join O'Daly's murder gang. Killers, National Army killers, all that sort of thing. And they're arrested, put in prison, and then brought up to Kilmainham. And the treatment of women in Kilmainham jail, Mountjoy jail, and the North Dublin Union is pretty brutal as well. And a lot of them go on hunger strike. A lot of them are beaten up by both the soldiers and indeed the Cumann na searchers. We had a great keynote in Tralee last weekend from Dr. Leanne Lane of DCU, who did a deep dive into Dorothy McArdle's Tragedies of Kerry. And McArdle talked to the widows and sisters and fiancés and loved ones of the men who were killed in Ballyseedy, Countess Bridge and other places about their suffering and the trauma that happened to them and the poverty that they sunk into, because many of the men killed were actually the wage earner in the household. And so now they're sinking deeper into poverty. But also the way they had to go and Molly O'Shea was the sister of George O'Shea, was killed at Ballyseedy. And she was one of the Cumann na mBan women who went there to pick up the bodies. And the bodies were in pieces. Dorothy McArdle talks about the flesh. The birds were eating the flesh off the trees for weeks afterwards. And Molly O'Shea loses her mind. She's been a Cumann na mBan woman through the War of Independence and the Civil War. And she is never the same afterwards. She spends the rest of her life institutionalized or at home in the care of her brother. And he applies for a pension for her. And it says, you know, in the terms of the time, one referee said, Molly O'Shea is now a complete imbecile. She just loses her mind. She can't do anything more. So that trauma, what we would now call PTSD, or what was called at the time neurasthenia. It is about their nerves are gone. And on top of that, you do have a number of gang rapes that happen during the Civil War, committed by anti-treaty IRA, one in Tipperary particularly, or National Army troops, one in Mayo, and a couple of more around the country. And mostly these are never prosecuted. The men who are involved get away with it. And our old friend, Paddy O'Daly, is hugely involved in one particular case after the Civil War is over in June in Kenmare in County Kerry, where he and two of his officers attack a house, take the two young women of the house, the McCarthy sisters, out the back, beat them up and rape them that night. And again, there's a court martial, completely whitewashed. He gets away with it, retires from the National Army and lives his life. So nobody's prosecuted for these crimes. So if anyone tells you that the War of Independence and Civil War in Ireland was a clean war when it came to violence against women and sexual violence as a weapon of war, gendered violence as a weapon of war, that's not true. All wars contain that, as we're seeing today, unfortunately, in the Ukraine now.
In relation to this question, is there a difficulty here? Because just like today, there's going to be a reticence on the mm-hmm. part of both the perpetrators and the victims, and particularly the victims, to talk about this, you know, because of the perceived shame and so on. And if that's the case, mm-hmm. how do you as a researcher deal with that? What mirror do you hold up to the evidence to yeah. extract the evidence?
Well, unfortunately, as in today, there's very little reporting, and the word outrage is used a lot of the time. So outrage is a coverall. Outrage can mean a house being burnt down or a stack of hay or a reek of turf being burnt or a house being wrecked during a raid or reprisal or animals being carted off by either side or a woman being attacked and raped or sexually assaulted or forcibly hair cropped. So outrage is a coverall term. And I think then you just have to look, you have to try and unpack what has been said here. Look at the entirety of the story, like that story of the six young women in Killarney. What happened then? Very short reporting in the Irish Independent, they were dragged out of bed, stripped and painted. Then the propaganda newspapers go into much more detail. Then you have the pension file, which actually is one of the victims reporting on what happened herself. So you have to treat these sources all with great care. As you will be learning from studying history, you don't take everything on face value. You have to treat it with care, mine down into the detail of what being said, try and match sources against each other and see what is being said over here and said over here. Sometimes it's very obvious, like the Mrs. Biggs gang rape in Tipperary in June 1922, where the Nina Guardian says the word rape, and there's no doubting about that. Sometimes it's very hidden, and you have to just mine down into the language that's been used, see what's happening in the context, understand that outrage is covering up a lot of what women don't want to say, because of course the shame and stigma and dishonour of that happening. And that's why it's such an effective weapon of war, even in the contemporary world, because it is about shaming and stigmatising women and shaming and stigmatising the men who couldn't protect them. So you do get people, some of the IRA men during the War of Independence, particularly saying how bad they felt that they couldn't protect their women. And the fact, putting on my feminist hat, the fact that we live in a patriarchal culture means that rape as a weapon of war will always be a powerful weapon, because it is about dishonouring the men who can't protect their women and shaming and stigmatising the women. So using women's bodies to send a message to the other side and also to stop militant women from being effective in their participation in any military struggle.
Okay, I'll move on to the next question. Chloe McManus, fifth year Muckross College.
How effective were the 450 Free State troops who landed from the Lady Wicklow ship in Fennet Pier in Kerry in August 1922? And were there many other naval attacks during the Irish Civil War?
John.
First of all, yeah, naval attacks was a big part in deciding the Civil War, because they... Republicans at the start of the Civil War held the province of Munster, essentially, and they were fighting reasonably effectively in County Limerick to keep out the pro-treaty forces. But they were outflanked by landings in Fianna and Kerry, and then at 3 points in County Cork, and the pro-treaty forces seized Cork City, which was, if you like, the capital of the anti-treatyites. Not quite without a fight, but almost, because they took them kind of from the flank, from behind. There's also a landing up in County Mayo, which was the same. And they're not so much naval attacks in the sense of you've got ships fighting ships, but they're very good ways of ferrying people around the coast of Ireland. Time is short, but the 450 troops who landed at Kerry were the Dublin Guard, who I mentioned before, under Paddy O'Daly. And they were tough fighters. They took the town of Tralee. For several months, they were kind of pinned in the towns of Kerry, them and the other troops there, the 1st Western Division, and some troops from Belfast, actually. But gradually they got on top of the anti-treatyites by an enormous amount of brutality, to be honest, in County Kerry, is the short version.
Brian, yeah?
I just want to say, because Paddy O'Daly has been mentioned again and again, and I suspect some of you are going, "What? Who the hell is this guy?" Those of you who've seen the Michael Collins movie will be familiar with the scene where a tough detective is brought down from Belfast to sort out Dublin Castle because Collins's men have put them on the defensive. And in the movie, he's blown up in the castle yard. That didn't happen, but what did happen was that the man brought down from Belfast was called District Commissioner Redmond of the RIC, and he's shot dead in Dublin by Paddy O'Daly. Paddy O'Daly had been a central member of Michael Collins' squad in Dublin right throughout the War of Independence, had been active in the IRB since 1907, had fought in the Easter Rising. So the guy who's doing all this stuff in Kerry, don't forget again, didn't fly in from the moon in 1921. He's been part of this. So this is part of the story of the Civil War. Some of these horrific things are being done by people who had been comrades with each other and people who are lionized in other circumstances. And I think when you look at Michael Collins' squad in particular, when you hear what they did in the Civil War, you can never look at them in the same way again when you think about what they were doing from 1919 mm-hmm. to 21 either.
And I think they're particularly, in Kerry, they're particularly antagonistic. I mean, they do the horrific things like Ballyseedy and the other massacres, and Clashmelkin as well, and also the extrajudicial killings. But they're particularly vicious towards women as well, because they had been fighting alongside coming them on, and they knew their effectiveness. Even in you know, say their big thing that they're known for, Bloody Sunday, after the killing of all the Dublin Castle intelligence agents in Bloody Sunday, they hand over the guns to the Cumann na mBan women, who then take them to the safe houses to keep them safe for the next action. So they know the effectiveness of Cumann na mBan, and they know what these women can do. And Paddy O'Daly is writing back from Kerry again and again through late 22 and into 23 about something has to be done about these crazy Cumann na mBan women. He says, don't take any account of their sex. They need to be dealt with as a menace, and it needs to be effective. He calls them the disciples of Mary McSweeney, who was seen as the maddest of the mad anti-treatyites. She's in jail and has been in hunger strike. She, of course, is the sister of Terence McSweeney, the Lord Mayor of Cork, who'd gone on hunger strike and died during the War of Independence, and had been a big propaganda coup for the Republican side during that time. And Mary McSweeney is seen as the leader of these mad anti-treaty Cumann na mBan. And Paddy O'Daly knows how effective these women are. You take them out of action, well, then you've dealt a fatal blow to the guerrilla war in Kerry. It might be a slow coming, but it would be a fatal blow.
Just on that question, just from a purely military point of view, you should bear in mind that any sort of an amphibious landing is one of the most hazardous operation a military force can undertake. So it's a minor miracle that it went off successfully, actually, in some ways, just from a purely military leader.
So they come into Tarbert as well, so
yeah,
they have
Tarbert,
to, and Kinmare.
Various parts of Cork. Mm-hmm. The other thing is they cobbled together a sort of a Free State Navy, right? But unfortunately then they dismantled it after the Civil War, and some people would say we've never had a proper Navy, but that's another discussion, right? Yeah, Brian, you want to just come in?
Just very briefly again, because we can't forget them. There's another participant in this war. The Royal Navy is very important to these amphibious landings, because the Royal Navy, okay, the world's most powerful navy, is providing support to the Free State Forces, so which the anti-treatyites cannot match in any shape.
Well, I mean, the Irish Free State isn't allowed to have a navy under the treaty, as I understand it, so it's kind of a grey area there, right? But listen, guys, I want to move on to our last question. Katie Daly of six-year Muckross College.
Yeah, so in 2012, Dunleary Rathdown County Council erected a plaque to commemorate Kevin O'Higgins at the site of his assassination on Christ Avenue in Booterstown. Red paint was quickly sprayed on it and it was quietly removed shortly after. Given the dubious legality of the Public Safety Bill in September 1922 and much else, should O'Higgins be commemorated by the Irish Free State, and if so, how? Yeah.
Colm, now there's several questions in there, right? Mm-hmm. Right. There's several issues there. Where do you want to start with this one, Colm?
I'd start by saying he's been hard done by in some respects. He has been blamed, if you want to use that word, for hard decisions by the government as a whole, to which he belonged. And he was a man who in many respects was deeply committed to the rule of law in the proper sense of the word, and ameliorated some tendencies towards repression on the part of the new government. You know, I think it's very important we remember the context here. I'm delighted so many of people have turned up here today for this History Ireland podcast, because if we don't remember our history, we're stupid. History is essential to understand the way the world works, just as psychology is to understand the way people work. And we've got to remember a few basic facts. The great majority of Irish people supported the treaty. They didn't approve of the Civil War. The five people elected by the Dáil to go to London all signed the conditional agreement for a treaty, which was then approved by a majority of the cabinet, then approved by Dáil Éireann, and then supported by most of the electorate. So what you had then was a provisional government. And Kevin Higgins famously said on one occasion, he described the work that they had to do. He said the provisional government was simply young men in the City Hall standing amidst the ruins of one administration with the foundations of another not yet laid and with wild men screaming through the keyhole. They were young too. They were incredibly young compared to governments today. I mean, Griffith at 50 was an old man compared to most of them. And Kevin O'Higgins played a central role in getting the government working. Now, they had to do things that were not very pleasant. And that happens in a situation where you have an insurrection against an elected government. And in the end, there were excesses. But the Public Safety Bill here that's mentioned, it had the support of most members of the Dáil who were prepared to turn up and to vote for it. And it allowed the government to take strict measures, including execution, against people who set out with arms to kill members of the elected government or its agents. And that was happening. Now, there were excesses. There were some people shot who didn't fall into that category. But most of the time, there was a process of law. You mightn't have liked the law. You might disagree with it, but that's what happened. Kevin O'Higgins went through all that. His father was killed in 1923 because of what he did. And he himself then, long after the Civil War was over, was shot down in Booterstown Avenue. I think it's remarkable that when Dunleary Rathdown Corporation put up a very simple plaque near the spot where he was assassinated with no contentious inscription on it, that got defaced. I didn't know that actually until I read this question earlier. I'd missed that fact. And it shows how our emotions still run very high. What we're talking about today hasn't gone away. It's still there. It's still there in Northern Ireland. It's going to be there if we push for a vote on the border, for instance. And if we get a majority in Northern Ireland to vote in favour of unity, but a majority of the unionist population does not, or of the Protestant population. These things bubble to the surface all the time. And, you know, I think somebody like Kevin Higgins was a sound pair of hands. I have no sympathy with Fine Gael. I've never been a Fine Gael supporter. I knew Kevin O'Higgins' daughter, Una O'Higgins O'Malley, because I was on the board of the Glen Cree Centre for Reconciliation for a while, and she played a great role there. She was a very forgiving woman. And Kevin O'Higgins, on his deathbed, forgave the people who killed him, who were never caught and who never were punished, but who were subsequently named as individual members of the IRA, who said they weren't following orders, they took it on themselves to kill him.
Tell you what, Brian, I'd like to bring Brian in here, but I want to just separate two things here. One is Kevin O'Higgins, the other is a question of memorials and commemoration, which I think is a very interesting question that your question has raised, and which Colm has alluded to. Just on Kevin O'Higgins, maybe first of all, Brian, on the public safety bill.
Well, I mean, we can't separate what happens in the Civil War from the people who are in power. And they're not simply, you know, men. The wild men include Paddy O'Daly. He's on the Free State side. The wild men include the British, who are also participants in this. Kevin O'Higgins isn't left on his own in Dublin. Ultimately, he has the backing of the British government. And the British had said quite clearly to the delegates in London in December 1921, you accept this deal. If you don't, the result will be immediate and terrible war. So the threat of that war was held over the Irish electorate in the early months of 1922, which makes it very hard to see this as a purely democratic decision, because if you vote the wrong way, there's going to be a war anyway. Now, ultimately, the Free State won. But a lot of the rottenness, I think, of Irish society and a lot of the horrible things we've uncovered in the last century can be traced to the fact that in order to win that victory, they were not only prepared to carry out multiple numbers of executions, mostly of very ordinary anti-treatyites who had done very little. There's very few senior IRA figures executed by the Free State. A lot of these guys are caught in possession with rifles or accused of sabotage, or often deserters from the National Army. So they're executing lots of ordinary volunteers in a way to terrify the rest of the IRA, but also a whole series of murders carried out by death squads, which is what is operating in Dublin when anti-treatyites are being killed by, again, people who the government know about. I mean, Bobby Bonfield, who's picked up by members of W.T. Cosgrave's escort at Easter 1923. W.T. Cosgrave, the head of the provisional government, sees Bonfield being taken away, who's an IRA member suspected of killing a Free State supporter. But Bonfield is a UCD dental student. His body turns up the next day at the Red Cow, where a lot of the bodies are dumped. W.T. Cosgrave knows that wasn't an accident. He knows it was done by his men, but yet it's tolerated because they need to win. But allowing that to happen then means that that state does become a state which allows a whole lot of other things to happen too. So in general, I agree with Frank Aiken's assessment. Frank Aiken very reluctantly enters into the Civil War on the anti-treaty side. He wants to stay out of it. And he says in August 22, war against the foreigner brings out all that's noble in a people. Civil war brings out all that's mean and base. The Civil War is a tragedy in many ways, but it's a tragedy if we remember it as a morality tale, a battle between democrats and dictators. It wasn't as simple as that. There was somebody else involved. The greatest empire in the world had decided there was a result they wanted, and also had worked very hard to divide the Irish revolutionary movement. So that has to be taken into account too when we remember this conflict and when we talk about commemorating it.
Now, I want to bring John into this, but just to preface this by saying that there were more National Army people killed in the Civil War than anti-treaty IRA. Am I correct in that, John?
Yeah.
Now, can you just, because I want to deal with this before we finish this, you're working on a project, John, at the moment, which is trying to calculate how many were killed, because it's amazing that we don't know. We still don't know. We do know pretty much pretty accurately how many were killed in the revolutionary period up to the truce, courtesy of that brilliant book by Ewan O'Halpin and Dáil Coráin. So we have names, places, everything, right? John, you're working on the next installment of this, if you like, into the Civil War.
Yeah, so it's a project that's been started down in University College Cork under Professor Andy Bielenberg. And yeah, so, you know, for all the terrible violence in Ireland in this period, you know, from 1916 onwards, the numbers killed are not enormous, right? So the numbers killed in the War of Independence in 1916 together is about 2,500. And the number killed in the Civil War is probably a little under 2,000. Of the numbers that we have so far, roughly 800 to 900 members of the National Army were killed.
Not all of them were killed in action, though. There's quite a few accidents in there and illness.
A lot of accidents, a lot of friendly fire. Because
something in the region of
ill-trained, you know, raw recruits who didn't know one end of a gun from the other.
I know. I mean, one of the saddest and most tedious things about doing this is going through all these files and finding all these people who died totally needlessly by accident. One difference between, on the other side, the anti-treatyites, not so many accidents. There's roughly 500 killed, of whom about half were executed in one way or another. So typically, National Army soldiers killed in action, whereas the guerrillas are killed after being caught and then executed. One difference between the Civil War and the War of Independence is that not that many civilians are killed in the Civil War. So it's about 200 to 300, we think. We're not expecting to find a whole lot more than that, although we're still counting. And a lot of them are killed in the crossfire, they're killed by accident, whereas in the war against the British, there's a lot of civilians killed on purpose. You know, there's about 800 killed. 200 of them are taken out by the IRA and shot in the head as informers. The Crown Forces killed a lot of civilians and they burned down towns. So the one saving grace of the Civil War, I suppose, is that civilians, generally speaking, were not targeted by either side. And there wasn't also a great deal of, there was house burning actually by the anti-treaty side a lot, but the Free State, the pro-treaty forces, did not do the whole collective reprisal thing that the Crown Forces did in the years preceding it.
And just by the way, just by way of comparison, right, the point is, like, this is not the only armed conflict that's taken place in Europe. You know, we think of the First World War finishing, you know, in 1918. There's a new concept used by historians now called the Greater War, which continues up to 1923-24. But if you look at other conflicts, say in Greece, Turkey, Finland, for example, has a civil war, 6 months, but 40,000 people are killed, right? So, you know, obviously this is quite a difficult thing for people, Irish people, to commemorate, but we do have to kind of take this, you know, step back a little bit and realize that the death toll was relatively low compared to what was happening elsewhere. It doesn't make it any less bitter, of course, you know. But I just want to bring Mary in, first of all, a column on the question of memorials, right? Because, and I want to go back to this question and the desecration might be the word, of memorials, because there's quite a big tradition of that, the length and breadth of the country. But anyway, Mary, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the memory wars and the memorials that are put up, you have way more memorials to anti-treaty men who were killed. And men, it's all men who were killed. There are no memorials to the women or what they did. Most of them weren't killed in the war, but they survived it. But you don't see any memorials to their experiences or activities. But in Kerry, for example, the biggest memorial is Ballyseedy Memorial, which will next week, because it'll be the centenary of Ballyseedy Massacre, where 9 men were taken out and tied around a mine by the National Army and taken Ballyseedy Cross, just outside Tralee. They were prisoners in Ballymullen Barracks in the workhouse in Tralee, having been arrested by the National Army. National Army troops had been killed 24 hours before or so in a trap mine. They were taken out to Ballyseedy Cross. It's about 2 miles or so outside Tralee town, and tied around a mine that had been prepared by the National Army and blown up. 8 of them were killed. There was one survivor, and that's how we know exactly what happened. Stephen Fuller survived, and he gives a statement about what happened. There's a huge memorial there now at Ballyseedy Cross, and if you watch the TV over the next week, you'll probably see it on the RT News about the commemorations of Ballyseedy Cross. And there are other memorials to anti-treaty men who were killed all around the country. Very few memorials to National Army men. And indeed, the one National Army memorial in Kerry, the Knocknagoshal Memorial, it's a very small, simple granite headstone type thing, has been sledgehammered a couple of times and replaced. But at least 3 times a sledgehammer has been taken to it. So the memorial wars, not just the civil war, the memorial wars are going on. And memorialization is a very contested thing. Who do we memorialise? It's always a very political thing. It's never neutral. So who puts up these memorials and why are they being commemorated? And one of the memorials, for example, in Nina in County Tipperary and one here in Grace Park Road of the same man, Martin Hogan, who was one of the group of men who invaded a home in Tipperary in June 1922 and were the supposed rapists of Mrs. Biggs. That man is on a memorial in the centre of Nina in County Tipperary, and he was killed then in Dublin in 1923, shot dead in Grace Park Road in Drumcondra, and there's a memorial at the spot he was killed. So you have to question, you know, what is the motivation behind commemorating these men? Like Paddy O'Daly, yes, they did things during the War of Independence, would see them as patriot, Republican patriots, but then they also do very questionable things. Paddy O'Daly himself is in a painting by the great Irish artist Sean Keating. And so when people talk about, you know, there's the statue wars at the moment, so they're taking down statues here, there and everywhere to slave owner, and the arguments are that you're ruining our history. Well, memorials don't tell us history. They tell us about politics. They tell us about people's motivation to commemorate certain people and why, but they aren't telling us history per se. So you have to separate out memorial and history, commemoration mm-hmm. and history. They're very different things, even though they are interrelated as well. So it'll be very interesting to see, you know, over the next week, how what happens at Ballyseedy and Countess Bridge and Bahas, because there were two other incidents within the week of Ballyseedy where more men were taken out and tied up. About 17 men altogether in three different incidences were executed by being tied around mines in Kerry, and they're all going to be commemorated over the next week or so. So that'll be very interesting to see. And that's why we had the Civil War Conference in Kerry the week before all of these, to be able to, you know, calmly and professionally and ethically have a conversation about what happened 100 years ago without all that emotion around being at the big memorial at Ballyseedy and things like that.
Colm, I'll probably give you the last word in this, Colm, because I'm looking at the time here.
I just before I make that point, may I say that I don't think the incident at Ballyseedy, which we hear an awful lot about, I don't think the families were done any favours when the organisers of the memorial had Ian Goulet make it. He was a sculptor, a Breton nationalist who came to live in Ireland, who was generally thought to have collaborated with the Nazis during World War II. And I don't think it was really very appropriate that he was going around Ireland putting up, being asked to put up memorials to one particular side in the Civil War. The point I wanted to make is that if you ask a lot of people what the Civil War was about, they think it's about partition, and they think partition was something created by the treaty talks in London. Partition had been created in 1920 by the British Government of Ireland Act, and De Valera had already acknowledged in August of 1921 that any county in Northern Ireland that wished would have the right to vote itself out of a new state. And what the treaty argument was about, fundamentally, were minor points that turned out to be not terribly important about the status of the king and about the oath that Irish deputies would have to take to it. The Civil War was about what? It's not always terribly clear. Did people really believe that they were going to restart the War of Independence and push the British and Unionists out of Northern Ireland? Very few senior IRA people thought that. Michael Collins didn't, and neither did a number of others. So it was a fairly futile exercise, very damaging to this country, suppressed for a long time. There were honourable people on both sides, but it was ultimately a very small minority. Don't think the Civil War, that in the Civil War, because the Doyle vote on the treaty was narrow for various reasons, don't think that the division in the country on the Civil War was narrow. It wasn't. At least three quarters of the country supported the treaty. Many reluctantly, including Michael Collins and Arthur Griffith. Nobody was in love with the treaty. Brian has mentioned the threat of force. Yes, the British threatened force. That had always been the situation. The question was, how did you respond to that threat of renewed warfare? Did you settle for something? Half a loaf or three quarters of a loaf, rather than fight on futilely a terrible war that would have caused more damage to an already traumatised country. Most people opted to take the treaty as a stepping stone to greater things, and that's how it turned out. We had a republic within 30 years.
Brian, just let you come in very briefly.
I don't want to restart the Civil War again with these questions, but, you know, even to say Collins knew that you couldn't drive the... Collins authorised an IRA offensive in May 1922 secretly. He was telling the IRA in the north, most of whom supported him, by the way. So again, the IRA north of the border,
pro-treaty, a lot of them. He was telling them that he would, within a year, have a big army, and then he'd do the business up there. So there's a lot of subterfuge, there's a lot of politics going on. To see it as simply as half a loaf being better than none isn't the way that people would have seen it. It was a question of sovereignty. Do great powers have the right to tell a colonised people what to do? Ultimately, that was the question. And for a lot of Republicans, they couldn't accept that. Now, there was a lot of other small print. I think the best thing you can do, and these are really great questions, by the way, but what you can, the best thing you can do is look at the lives of people 100 years ago, look at the real experiences of them. We are so lucky in this state. And one of the great things about the decade of centenaries has been that the state has allowed for the digitization of the witness statements, of the pension files. We can get a glimpse of the lives of these people. My granduncle, Tom Leahy, one of those National Army soldiers killed by one of his comrades, accidentally. A young fellow of 18 joined the army in Limerick in August 1922. No politics, as far as I know, no Free State tradition in the family, just joined for whatever reason. I can read about, you know, his life essentially and how it ended and how his family looked for a pension. We're very lucky. In a lot of places, they can't do that. So I think we do have the ability now to have our very strong, heartfelt political views on the Civil War, but also to look back and look at the lives of people as they were lived. And they were people just like us. This is the thing. We are not special. They were people just like us faced with this horrible, horrible choice. But I think that choice was ultimately the big decisions, unfortunately, were being made in Westminster and not by people on the ground in Dublin.
OK, I'm going to wrap it up there, guys. First of all, I'd like to thank Gonzaga College for hosting this marvellous discussion. And I have to say, guys, the quality of the questions there were pretty good, right? Not pretty good, but best we've had, actually. So I'd like to thank our panel here, Colm Kenny, Mary McAuliffe, John Dorney, and Brian Hanley. Our next History Ireland Head School will be next month, and it will be looking at Archbishop John Charles McQuaid, who probably means absolutely nothing to most of you sitting in this room. I was going to say ask your parents, but you'd probably have to ask your grandparents. They'll certainly know a thing or two about him. So I hope maybe you can tune into that. And of course, this head school will be posted as a podcast, I think, tomorrow week. So it's Friday the 10th, if you want to have a listen back to it. So again, thank you all for your participation, particularly those students who ask questions. Thank you very much.